Today we mark Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It's a very, very special day in the Jewish calendar. Chazal tell us that there are many things that happened on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, including the construction of the Mishkan on a permanent basis was on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Moshe Rabbeinu comes before Klal Yisrael on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, just prior to Yitzias Mitzrayim. And he tells us that on the 10th of the month, we have to set aside a set, the base always, the lamb for the Korban Pesach, which we will sacrifice on the 14th. The day is so significant that there is a portion of the Haggadah which addresses that day. Right? In the language of the Mechilton actuality, V'higata Levincha, is Yochel Merosh Chodesh. The month is so significant, Rosh Chodesh is so significant, is auguring in the final stages of Yitzias Mitzrayim, of the Geula, that we might have thought that it's worthy that from Rosh Chodesh Nisan we should begin to explore on a regular basis all the aspects of Yitzias Mitzrayim. The Torah relegates it, particularly to the night of Pesach. But it's a very important day. Yitzias Mitzrayim is so important. In the Tefillin we have four parashiyos. Two of them we understand full well. We have Shema Yisrael and Vayom Shamaya. This is the very basis of our faith, the Kriya Shema. So of course that's in the Tefillin. But there are two additional parashiyos in the Tefillin, and that's the final portion of Parshas Bo, of Kadosh Li Kol Bechor V'Hayakim V'Yachol. These are two parashiyos which discuss, they mention the Tefillin, but they also mention Yitzias Mitzrayim. They're significant. There are 54 mitzvahs in the Torah, which are Zechel Yitzias Mitzrayim. 54. 1/12 of the mitzvahs. And I find the parasha very striking. Vayomer Moshe Elohim. We should forever remember the day that we were released from bondage with a powerful hand. The great miracles of Yitzias Mitzrayim, the Ten Makas, the Kriyas Yamsuf. And therefore, we have the Chag of Pesach. That I understand. It's a very powerful opening statement of Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's consider for a moment the Yitzias Mitzrayim. And then he goes to a pasuk, which is very, very hard to understand. It's hard to understand at any level that it should be that significant that it should be in this parasha. And what its significance is altogether. He writes, Hayoyim Atam Yotzim. Oh, by the way, please note that the day today that we are leaving, the Chodesh Adar, it's springtime. Not something, as Rashi notes, that you have to tell too many people that it's springtime. If it's springtime, people know it's springtime. They don't think it's December. They don't think it's January. They know it's springtime. So why does he have to tell this to them? Altogether, something that he obviously knows. And at a deeper level, what's its significance? He just talked about one of the most significant, or the most significant event in Jewish history, other than Matan Torah itself, is Yitzias Mitzrayim. The Rabbeinu Shalom unleashed his power to take you out of Mitzrayim. And then you start talking about the weather. So Rashi comments that what Moshe Rabbeinu was pointing to, the Rabbeinu Shalom could have taken us out of Mitzrayim at any time of the year. But he took us out in the springtime. It's pleasant in the spring. You know, I went today without a jacket. You don't need a jacket when you go out. You don't freeze. There's no ice falling on you. It's pleasant. It's mild. But the question still remains. It begs the question. Amin was incarcerated for 20 years in prison. Unlawfully. He shouldn't have been in jail. They made it, there was a miscarriage of justice. They put him into jail. 20 years later, they find exculpatory evidence and he's exonerated. It's December 23rd, it's 3 degrees outside, the wind is howling, the snow is blasting down, and he walks out the prison door. What does he know? What does he experience? The weather? All he hears is music to his ears. The door of the prison slams behind him, and he's on the outside. That's all he hears. The rest is all irrelevant. What's its significance? It all fades away. What's its importance? Person lo aleinu, in our era, those people that survived the concentration camps, so the Russians freed them, the Americans freed them, the British freed them. It's a big nafkamina, a big difference to them. It was sunny that day, it was cloudy, it was 30 degrees, it was 50 degrees. Baruch Hashem, I went to Movas L'chaim. My life was hanging by a thread a minute ago, and now I was spared, and I was able to rebuild a life. The weather? Who cares about the weather? What significance is the weather? When Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching us, if we want to appreciate the great chasadim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have to begin with the simplest chasadim. The tiny, tiny chasadim that are almost insignificant, that we can tend to overlook as being of no importance. The Rabbeinu Shalom pays attention to that level of detail in doing chesed for us. Something which was, there's almost no palpable difference between if it was December or April when they went out of Mitzrayim. Of course, it was a touch more comfortable. He didn't have to pull his coat around him. That was also part of the chesed of the Rabbeinu Shalom. And we find this is not the only place in Yetzias Mitzrayim that we find this. At the end of the Shiras Hayam that we recite each day, we say that the Jewish people went b'soy Hayam by Yabosha. This elsewhere is referred to as Becharovo. Yabosha is dry. Charovo means hard, very dry. If you've ever gone to visit a river and there's a wetland next to it, so you know you have to be careful. If you get too close to the river, you'll fall in the mud up to your knees. It's one thing that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam stopped the Yamsuf in its tracks. So now we're marching in the Yamsuf. But what should the bottom of the Yamsuf be? In all the millennia, it's been covered by water. It's a muddy place. So we should have marched through. Our shoes should have been muddy. Our pants should have been muddy. It should have been not the greatest experience. When we came out, we'd have to send our pants to the dry cleaners. But the Rabbeinu Shel Olam made another nest after Kriyas Yamsuf that is with Becharovo. It was dry. They went on hard earth. So the pants didn't get dirty. The shoes didn't, the feet didn't get soiled. The Egyptian army is chasing after them. If they don't have this escape path, they're doomed. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam opens up an escape path. It makes a difference. A person runs away for his life and he succeeds. His shoe got muddy. It didn't get muddy. But the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is concerned even for that. And we find this is a midah of the Oveis as well. The birth of Yosef was one of the very poignant events in Chumash Bereishis. Rachel tells Yaakov Avinu that the anguish that I have of not being childless is unbearable. And if it's not resolved, I will die from the anguish that I feel. Finally, she has a child. And she names the child Yosef. So the Chumash tells us, right, in one of the expressions is, Osaf Hashem es cherposi. So one simple explanation of that is that she felt unaccomplished and unsatisfied that she didn't have a child. So now the Rabbeinu Shalom has rectified that problem for me. But Rashi tells us something else. Osaf Hashem es cherposi, that until now something broke in a house. If a vase fell down and broke. So they said, you know, Rachel is a klotz. She has two left hands and three left feet. You know, what do you expect of her? That's what happens in a house. Now no one's going to say that about me anymore. If something breaks in my house, there's a toddler running around. So what do you expect? Toddlers knock things over all the time. That's what she was concerned about. On the day that she becomes fulfilled, and she said she feels a breath of life, on that day she's concerned, well, they're going to consider me, because I have a child, I won't be considered a klutz anymore. That's what's on her mind. The answer is no. The answer is she certainly thanked the Rabbeinu Shel Olam for the gift of a child. But what she expressed was, my thanks to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is not only for the great gift of the child, for all the little tiny things that come along with it. Even down to the fact that I won't be called a klutz. Also have to thank the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. if we pick up on the little things and the small chassadim that the Rabbeinu Shalom does for us, then we first begin to appreciate in full measure the great chassadim that the Rabbeinu Shalom does for us. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu tells them, Zochor as hayom azeh she yitzosa mi Mitzrayim. You went out of Mitzrayim today. It's true. If you want really to be able to take the full measure of appreciation to the Rabbeinu Shalom for this, is hayom atam yitz b'chodesh Aviv. Start from the tiniest chesed. And he did. The smallest of the chassadim he did for us today is the weather was nice. If we stop to contemplate that the Rabbeinu Shalom even provided that, then we'll start to build upon that to fully take measure of the great chassadim that he did for us. And that's the essence of the Yontif of Pesach is Eidom, to thank the Rabbeinu Shalom for that which he's done. It's a very strange part of the Haggadah, very strange. And the typical explanation that you hear in Cheder is very unsatisfying to me, I have to tell you. It may be an explanation in and of itself, but in the Haggadah it really doesn't fit very well. We know that in Mitzrayim, the Chatumim, the sorcerers of Paro, described the Makos as Etzba Elokim, it's the finger of Hashem. When we came to Yamsuf, Vayar Yisrael es Hayod HaGdoilo, Klal Yisrael saw the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Tanoim all agreed that the implication of those two psukim is that the number of the makas which took place at Kriyas Yamsuf was a factor of five times as much as compared to the makas which took place in Mitzrayim. Okay, fine. So the first Mandi almost the first view states, well, as we know, there were 10 makas in the Torah. Yeah, right, Dom Tzvadeya all the way up to 10. So what took place at Yamsu was five times as much, 50 makas, fine, okay. Then we have another view in the Tanoim that says each makas was fourfold, Evro, Azam, etc. And therefore, the 10 makas are really 40, and the 50 are really 200. And then along comes Rabbi Akiva, and he says, no, the 10 makas were fivefold, and they're really 50, and therefore on Yamsu there were 250 makas. Of what particular concern is this for us on the night of the Seder? We're concerned how many makas were given to Mitzrayim. What are we concerned about? So in Cheder, what they teach you in Cheder is that it says in Parshas B'Shalach, Kol Machlosh Samdi V'Mitzrayim La'osim Alecho Ki Ani Hashem Reifecho. That all the afflictions of Mitzrayim will not touch the Jewish people ever. So therefore, we want to, in fact, magnify the number of their afflictions because our brocha is greater in that regard. Okay, so now I'm not against the pshat, but it does not really explain what this is doing in the Haggadah. That's not the thrust of what the Haggadah is about. The answer is the Haggadah is Haidah. Haidah means the fullest expression of thanksgiving to the Rabbeinu Shalom. And therefore, we have to know what exactly did the Rabbeinu Shalom do for us? How many nisim did he do for us? Each nes, we have to say halal another time. So we have to know, in fact, how many nisim that there were, so that we should recite the Haidah, the thanksgiving to the Rabbeinu Shalom, in the halal in appropriate fashion. And that's what the Tanoim are debating. How many nisim were there? How great is our obligation to recite Haidah to the Rabbeinu Shalom? And this really is the side of what the whole Chag of Pesach is. This is what it's about from beginning to end. Recognizing all that the Rabbeinu Shalom does for us individually, collectively, and throughout our history. And that really is the side why we have, of all the celebrations that we have during the year, all the Chagim and Shabbos, the one that we take the most stringent approach to is Pesach. More so than any other, more so than Shabbos, more so than any other celebration in Jewish life. And we even have the halacha, the Peskim. It's not only because it has a very grave punishment of Koresh, that's one view, but we find in the Peskim that there's another aspect to it. It's called Chumrah de Pesach. In general, when it comes to Pesach, we take a very strict stance. And I believe the reason for it is very simple. If I want to thank someone, how do I thank someone? Someone brought me, you know, let's say I'm a Rebbe, and someone brought me lunch every single day the whole year. I went to the dining room, he got lunch together exactly what I wanted, brings it up to my office, and I eat like a mensch. I don't have to schlep downstairs. Wait, I go to my office, every day he brings it. Comes the month of June, the year's about to end, so I want to show some expression of appreciation to him. So suppose we're here in Kew Garden Hills. So I go, I call up a Pisgah, and I said, listen, I want you to do the best and the biggest steak sandwich that you have. And I want you to deliver it lunchtime to this guy. Okay? To show him what I eat, and I write to him, that I appreciate what you did a whole year. Now, what would you say if I brought him a steak sandwich where the bread was stale and the meat was cooked 3 days ago? So you say, what's with you? A guy took care of you for a whole year. That's all you have to do for him is give him stale bread and dried out meat. And that's the answer of everything of Chumrah de Pesach. We come to thank the Rabbeinu Shalom for all he's done for us. On the time of the special Thanksgiving of Pesach, nothing is enough. We strive in everything that we do that it should be at the highest level of service of the Rabbeinu Shalom for that reason. Because that's the only way that we can properly express our daughter to thank someone. If I cut corners, so it tells you exactly what I think, that I know they don't owe you too much. If I really believe that I owe you something, there are no shortcuts. Everything is at the highest level. And that's the yisoid of Pesach, the yisoid of the kashas of Pesach, the yisoid where every family has its minhagim. More so than any other time of the whole year. Every family has a roster of minhagim. How to celebrate this particular chag. Why? Because that was their feeling, that they were inspired to place special emphasis on certain areas. And it's one of the universal features in Klal Yisrael. So that's what we come to celebrate when we celebrate Pesach. And that's, as I said, why the halacha takes such a strict stance. It's the only time, basically a whole year, that we run into something where there's no bittul. If one speck of chametz falls into a big pot of soup, that's it. The pot of soup is gone. I have to throw it out. It's 1,000 times as much as that one tiny crumb of chametz matzah mel that fell in. Doesn't help me. Throw it out. If you're an Ashkenazi, I used this pot 6 months ago to last on, and I mistakenly cooked in it for Pesach. Throw it out. Loisin tam levgam. Comes to Pesach, everything is at the highest level. And that's, Rabbi said, the stance that we have to take. We're serving the Rabbeinu Shalom to express our thanks to the Rabbeinu Shalom. We are an eternal people. From Avram Avinu until today is almost 4,000 years. From Avram Avinu until today. And, you know, I taught 10th grade for many years. So I do like to know what my students are up to, what they're studying in their secular studies as well. So I used to take their books and thumb through their books to see what, you know, I should know what they're learning in school or what they're supposed to be learning in school. So in my day they called it world history, nowadays they call it global studies. So I pick up the book, and at the beginning of the book, on one of the first pages of the book, there's a list of ancient peoples of the world. Four or five nations are listed there. The Hittites, to this one, to that one. So I read the list and I stop and I ask my students, let me read you this list. Who's the only one on this list that you know about? Right? There's the Hebrews, the Jews, the descendants of Avraham Avinu, we're still around. The Hittites, until the 1930s, the only thing the world knew about them were the few sentences about them in Chumash and their dealings with Avraham Avinu. They totally disappeared from the face of the earth. In the 1930s, there was a secular scholar. They left behind cuneiform tablets, something like a hieroglyphics language. And a secular scholar finally broke the code of the language and was able to interpret. They found a huge amount of these tablets. And they were able to find out where in the world they came from, what they were about. There were people that came from someplace in Turkey. They were a very powerful and aggressive people, and they conquered a big part of the Middle East. Right? They were a major player in the Eretz Yisrael on Avraham Avinu's time. 2,000 years later, this earth swallowed them up. They disappeared. A powerful nation that ruled over a big part of the globe. To the extent no one knew anything about them. Nothing. At least the Incas, you go, there's something left of them out there in Peru. Something's left of them. Nothing. The Hittites were swallowed up as if they never existed. And who's around? The descendants of Avraham Avinu. That's the gift the Rabbeinu Shalom has given us. Been a long and difficult road, but one that we've never lost confidence in, that the Rabbeinu Shalom will sustain us. When it comes to Pesach, we celebrate the Nitzchias, the eternity of Klal Yisrael. All our celebrations are celebrations, as Tzal said, stem from within the halacha itself. We don't have a halacha and a hashkofa, two different parts, you know, celebrations and then technical laws. The essence of the halacha really expresses everything that a chag is about. And if one hasn't pondered the ultimate depths as a brisker might of the halacha, then the spirit of the yontif will evade him forever. You cannot capture one without the other. It stems from the very body of the halacha itself. We observe kashrus at the highest level of the year. You know, I was once speaking to people that run the kitchen, and non-Jews that run a kitchen in a nursing home. So they met me, it was Passover time. And I said, Rabbi, these rabbis that came to us to kosherize the place for Passover? When New York State is about to come here, these guys should come here. He says, the place is never so clean that when they finish, the rest of the year, the next 364 days, is never as clean as the day they finish kosherizing it for Passover. This is, the place is immaculate. There's nothing like this. It's the kir that we put into the kir madin that goes beyond anything that the world can expect. So, we have to, Baruch Hashem, Yontif is 2 weeks from now. We have a great deal of work to do from now until Yontif. But the joy of Yontif is by and large commensurate with the effort that goes into it. Rabbi Soloveitchik has long observed that the things that are most precious to us in life are the things that we work hardest for. Our children are so precious, Kanayin Hara, because we work so hard for them. That's what makes them really as precious as they are. It's not an easy yontif. I tell people that, to me, the ultimate proof that Torah is min hashamayim is the Chag of Pesach. There's no human being would have dared to perpetrate this on anyone else. Only the Rebbeinu Shlomo could make such a yontif. Now, to begin kashering the kitchen, we have to start with the stovetop. Because one of the requisite items that we need to kosherize the kitchen is hot water. So we have to be able to kosherize the stovetop so we can have hot water, which is kosher the Pesach. So to clean the stovetop, any of the compartments underneath where the food falls down, we should do a basic cleaning of them. We don't have to go crazy to make sure that there's not a single crumb or speck left down there. Because we're not eating any food that's going to fall down into the bottom. We're going to leave it down there anyhow. So what do we have? So a basic cleaning of the areas underneath. Then we have to clean the stovetop well. And the basic thing that we have to do is we have to cover it. There are all types of enamel areas and metal areas which are very, very hard to kosher appropriately for Pesach. And therefore, the general practice and the appropriate practice is to cover them. They should be covered well-lined with a strong aluminum foil. And then we have to kosher the grates. Now, the grates are not a big deal. The cleaning is harder than the koshering of the grates. To kosherize the grates, there are two possibilities. One has a gas range, or one has an electric stove. Those are the two possibilities. Now, the reason that it's relatively elementary and how to kasher the grates is because in actuality, the halacha is if a non-Jew came into my house on Erev Pesach in the afternoon and put a pot on the fire, which had chazer and pasta inside it, and he cooked it there for an hour and took it off, in straight bottom line halacha, my grate is still 100% kosher for Pesach. Anything that we do after that, the Rambam insists that we have certain chumras. So we have chumras. But we're starting off baseline, we can't go wrong. So then we build upon that. So to kosherize the grates, one has to put on the fire for about 15 minutes and cover each of them like with a little teepee of aluminum foil. You want basically the foil should be raised enough, the fire should hit just around where the grates are, and it shouldn't burn through the aluminum foil. So you want to raise the aluminum foil up in the middle above where the fire is, so it's covered. Now, don't cover the entire stovetop in one shot, because if you do, you're going to singe the enamel, and you're going to regret it for the rest of the year. But just cover over the area of the grate itself, do a one or two at a time, put it on for 15 minutes with the fire up, and it's kosher for Pesach. That's very simple. If you have an electric stove, then it's even easier than that. Put it on high for a few minutes, and it's kosher. If you're not sure if it's kosher, throw a piece of aluminum foil on. After a few minutes, it'll turn red. So you know you went even further than you have to do to kosherize it. So koshering the stove top, the actual grates itself, is a very simple process. The cleaning is a much bigger process. Now, the jets, really, you should just clean them. They do not need any kosherizing, because the jets do not come in direct contact with the food. If you have a glass top stove, I will speak to you privately about it. It's a major problem, because glass top stoves cannot be covered. I've mentioned many other times that one of my friends bought a glass top stove. He put on a blech on it for Shabbos. I came to his house on Sunday, and it was in about 1,000 pieces. Just the heat destroyed it. Now, once the stovetop is kosher, you have to be careful when you line the top to leave some openings. If you have an oven under the stovetop, that the heat should be able to vent out. So if there are vents in the back, punch holes in that particular area. Now, you also have to cover the backsplashes behind the stovetop, and above the stovetop, you should also cover any hoods that there may be. There is steam, which goes out, is expressed from the pots, which hits the back walls, hits the top where the hoods are. For the whole year, we have a terem for it. But when it comes to Pesach with chametz, we're very, very tight in a terem. So therefore, it's correct to cover the backsplashes, and if there's a hood on top, to cover the hood too. So that in case there is any steam, it does not come in contact with a chametz sticker surface. Now, that's the basic story of stoves. And once you finish with the stove, then you can take a Pesach chinuk, catch a tea kettle, start boiling water. When the water boils, then you can start on the sink. Now, the sinks come in two types, as far as I'm concerned. And that is, if you were assuming at the moment that it's not your normal practice to put hot pots directly into the sink. If they are, that's a separate problem we'll have to talk about separately. But let's assume that you don't normally put hot pots directly into the sink. So then what you have to do is pour hot water all along the walls, up and down, all across the bottom and the sides. It takes a lot of tea kettles to do this. I go slowly, and I've managed to do maybe about an eighth with each tea kettle to go around my sink, and then to do the floor of the sink, and then to pour some water down the drain. So that's step number one. So I usually, when I kosherize in my house, I use three kettles. Two of them I put away for the rest of the yontif that I don't look at. But for kosherizing, I want to be able to have the hot water coming up as fast as I can. So I use three. Now, sinks often have an aerator where the water comes out of, that unscrews from the tip of the faucet. If you have one that unscrews, you should replace it if you can for yontif. Now, the drain is also an issue down the drain, because if you ever opened up the drain, or saw the plumber open up the drain, you'll see everything that you've eaten for the last 3 weeks down there. So we do need to make sure that there's no chametz that could present the problem in case the sink backs up. And consequently, one should pour ammonia down the drain and let it sit there for 15 to 20 minutes, or something else, caustic. And then after 15 or 20 minutes, then flush it out. And that way, we will not have to be concerned if there's any chametz left down there. It'll certainly reach an inedible state. Now, the spout also has to be kosherized for the obvious reason that, you know, we spill things into the sink. Yeah, we sometimes spill chametz sticker things into the sink. We can drain noodles in the sink, and the hot water can splash onto the spout. So the spout should be kosherized by pouring hot water on it. And even on the bottom, hold the kettle underneath and sort of splash it up so you get the bottom part too. Now, I should take one step back. Whenever you're kosherizing anything with hot water, general rule, is the following, that you should not use it for hot for 24 hours before. Anything you kosherize them with hot water. Those things that you kosherize with dry heat, this din does not apply to. You can use them within 24 hours. But anything you're kosherizing with hot water, you should not use within 24 hours. So consequently, you should close the hot water on your sink for 24 hours before you want to kosherize, so that no one accidentally turns it on. And then you're going to have a problem if you have to start counting the 24 hours again. So just climb under the sink if you have a check valve, close the hot water, and after 24 hours, then you'll kosherize the sink. Now, you also, if you have many people in the drain, keep strainers there to keep the pieces from falling down and stuffing up the plumbing, so those strainers should be replaced with different ones for Pesach. If you use a stopper in the sink sometimes to soak the dishes, you should also replace that for Pesach. And if you... the spray pot of the sink. So if it's made of metal, basically, you can kosherize it. If it's made of plastic, then you should just close it up for Pesach. The way to kosherize it is to just to pull it all the way out and dump hot water on it along the length of the pipe and along the place where it spritzes from at the end, and that's kosher for Pesach. We're assuming it's plastic, you should close it up for Pesach. Now, this is all assuming that you have a stainless sink. If, however, you have either you normally put hot pots into the sink or you have a non-metal sink, porcelain or whatever, then you should cover up the sink for Pesach. Better off if you pour the hot water first on it, but the bottom line is what you have to do is, at the end of the day, you have to cover it. There are methods of koshering a sink that you put hot pots into regularly. But these are methods that are not intended for home kitchens, and they're not intended for people that are not professional kosherists. So I don't want to get into them. You know, they are not safe in a home kitchen. The materials in a home kitchen are too delicate. You know, in commercial kitchens, there's no wood. Zero. It doesn't exist. The walls are made of tile, and everything else in the kitchen is made of stainless. So there's very, very little flammable and very little that can get ruined in a commercial kitchen. And that lends itself to different types of methods of heat, which are not safe for the equipment, and not safe for the person using it unless the person is a professional at using them. Now, countertops basically are the same story as sinks, meaning that there are two possibilities as far as I'm concerned. Is something that's made of natural stone, not composite, whether it's marble or whether it's granite in this country is more likely, in Israel is more likely to be marble, but if it's not a composite, or if you, for some unusual reason you have a stainless counter in your house, most people don't, it's not normal in homes, but if you do, then assuming again that we don't put hot pots directly on it normally, what we need to do is to take hot water and pour it over all the areas of the surface, and it does not have to be covered for Pesach. You can use it uncovered. So that's just makes life a lot easier, a lot more comfortable and normal that you don't have to cover it over. Now, if you have formica or you have composite stone in all its various forms, then you certainly have to cover it. If you want to pour hot water on it besides, that's for extra credit. But the main thing you have to do is to cover it. Now, it's preferable, it's a very good idea to cover the backsplashes of the countertops too. But around the stovetops, it's really mandatory because there is hot steam and there's hot food. On the counters, we don't usually work with hot food, so it's preferable to cover them, but bottom line, if you wash them very well and they're super clean, then you don't put hot there, so you would also be fine. Now, tables are a very small matter. Basically, you have to clean them off, whatever surfaces you actually use during the year. You know, if it's a dining room table, you probably never use the surface. So just change the tablecloths and put on something. We like to put on something which doesn't let heat go through so well on Pesach. The extra chumrah of Pesach. So yeah, they have these like hard plastic things they sell in the hardware stores that you actually trim with a scissor or a razor to size. And to cover the table with them, they're very good. They last for a long time. I put mine away from one Pesach to the next. And they're already not a pre-cut. I don't have to bother to cut them again to the exact size I want them to be. And the main thing with a table is to wash it well. If it's a table that has puts in extra leaves, so then open it up in the crack and clean out the crack, because the crack always gathers in the course of a year a great deal of dirt in it. And the tablecloths, you should have different ones for Pesach. If you have a cloth tablecloth that you can wash and it's stain-free, after you wash it, you can use it for Pesach as well. So we usually like to put a cloth, something which doesn't allow liquid to go through. It could be the plastic things underneath that you're using to keep the heat out. They're also covered in plastic that would also keep liquid from going through. But something which both stops the heat and the liquid from going through. And after that, a tablecloth. Refrigerators, the main thing with refrigerators is to wash them well. And remember to clean the top of the gasket of the door. In the course of the year, somehow stuff manages to get up there. And it's a place that it can fall into the food on Pesach. So therefore, always clean on the top of the gasket of the refrigerator door. It is not mandatory to cover the shelves in most instances. And principally, the fridges don't work so very well, most of them, if you cover the shelves, because it impedes the air circulation. And a lot of models, the models that have like wire racks, those types of models, there are those that have glass shelves, so there's really not much of a difference because they're designed to work around the shelves, the circulation of the air. But one with wire racks, you're better off, you have to wash them very well, but you're better off not covering the racks because it interferes with the circulation of the air around the varied parts of it. If you put hot pots directly on the shelves, then you should cover the shelves. So that depends what you do during the year. Now, the closets in the kitchen is basically, you should wash them well, vacuum them well, and cover the shelves. And the reason is we're never going to be 100%, in most of the materials that our cabinets are made from, we're not going to be 100% sure that everything is perfectly clean, that we don't have a speck of chametz left. And since these are places that we're storing food and dishes, this is merely the biggest problem that we could have on Pesach. Because, as I mentioned before, if a tiny speck of chametz falls into the food, we're in big trouble. Now, the oven is a challenge. The first thing is, basically, you have to make sure your oven is relatively clean. And that is, even if you are very clean, we'll see in a moment, but it has to be at least relatively clean, even if you have a self-cleaning oven. Because if you self-clean a dirty oven, what's going to happen? You're going to make a fire. You have a friend of mine that it happened to. The night before Pesach, he decided to put on the self-cleaning oven, and he wasn't particularly careful about cleaning it, and all of a sudden the flames were shooting out of the vents. But he was a gadgety type of guy, so he had a fire extinguisher in the kitchen, which is a good idea to have, and he shot it into there, and he actually put the fire out. The fire department came, and everything was fine in his apartment, except for some soot that he had to clean up. But none of us need that the night before Yom Tov. So better to clean it first. If you have a non-self-cleaning, you certainly have to clean it, because otherwise it's never going to get kosher. Now, if it's self-cleaning, clean it out, basically. Put it on for 3 hours for self-cleaning with the racks inside, and it's kosher to go as is. I prefer strongly to cover the inside of the door. Now, I did have one person come to me, it's the only time that it's happened, and said that his wife covered the inside of the door last year and his oven didn't work properly, the temperature was off the charts. So I called today a person that understands the engineering of these things, and he was scratching his head, he couldn't figure out a reason why it should have happened. Somehow they must have done something which interfered with the thermostat. Now, the thermostat is not usually by the door, the thermostat is usually in the back of the oven. Because if they hadn't interfered with the thermostat, even if the temperature went awry in the oven, it would have shut down. The thermostat would have regulated it. So he could not figure out what exactly happened, but other than that, somehow must have interfered with the thermostat's operation. How, we could not figure out. So by and large, it remains just, you know, try to see where the thermostat is in your oven, and I don't believe it's usually in the front. But the reason I like to cover the door, I've become my oven, for example, and many vent the whole year through the door itself. And that's how the fumes go out of the oven, is through the door. And inside, there's an oily residue in between the, there's an oily residue in between the two, the outer glass and the inner glass of the oven. And I just was not sure. I still haven't found someone yet that's able to tell me exactly, but I was not sure if the self-cleaning really burned everything up or it was still somewhat oily inside. I couldn't tell. So that's the reason I've opted in the last number of years to cover over the, just the inside of the door in a self-cleaning. Now, if you don't have a self-cleaning, then it's a whole process. First of all, you have to clean the oven out thoroughly. Now, the first thing you should do is get yourself a pair of gloves and a pair of safety goggles for your eyes. You know, we all want to emerge from preparing for the yontif for one piece. And for a few dollars of protecting our eyes and our hands from the caustic chemicals that are used for this purpose is well worth the investment. They're readily available almost in any place that sells hardware. You can get a pair of safety goggles and some gloves. Now, you have to clean the inside of the oven out well. After it's cleaned, put it on the highest heat for about an hour and a half. And I'm of those that have that view that after that you should still cover the oven inside. And that's not so easy to do, but you need very thick aluminum foil. Make a U-piece, which goes on the right wall, the back, and the left wall. And they should lap one piece, lap all the way around till it sticks out of the seam where the door connects, closes on the oven. Cover the bottom, and once you have this U, you can put something on top of it which will rest against the top of the oven and stay in place. You fold it up in the front as it comes out of the oven. It's a job. I did it for many years. But then after that, what you have to do is be very careful as you go down the walls. You have the tracks that the racks rest upon. So you have to push the aluminum foil in very, very gently as you're coming down the wall, that it's tight against the tracks, so you can get the racks back in without tearing it apart. Now, if you succeed in that, if you succeed, do not take out the racks for the rest of the yontif. Just leave them in and take the pots out. Because if you start sliding the racks up and back, the silver foil is not going to survive. Now they have today, like I use on the stovetop in our house, they have very, very thick aluminum foil. Very thick. It's almost, how can I say, it's like tin, literally, that you can, it's still bend with your hand, but it's literally like tin. And the advantage of it, once you cover the stovetop with it, it has never torn in all the years. And they've never popped a hole in it. So it maintains its integrity very, very well. So most of them come from Eretz Yisrael, and a lot of the stores selling things for Pesach do sell it. They come in rolls about, I don't know, 3 feet or so long, something like that. Now, if you don't have a self-cleaning oven, you should give your racks to one of your friends that has a self-cleaning oven, because there we put the pots directly on it and run them through one self-cleaning cycle. The most that will happen, they will discolor slightly, but they will be absolutely functional when you finish. So microwaves and dishwashers, I don't like the kasha, you know, and especially in today's world where microwaves are as cheap as they are, unless you have built-in ones, you know, that you can't do anything about. But if you don't have built-in ones, you certainly shouldn't bother to kasha them. If you have built-in ones and the insides are made of stainless, as a lot of them today are, you have to wash them very, very well and then take a cup of water. Better, if you're using plastic cups, take two plastic cups, because that way they won't melt, and fill it with water. Pour water on the floor of the microwave where the cup is, so there'll be water underneath there, and put it on for about 10 minutes. When you open it up, you will feel that the walls are hot. So that means the steam spread out, and that's the way it becomes chometzdik, and that's the way it becomes pesach tiktun. If there's a glass turntable on the bottom and plastic, you have to take them out. You cannot kosherize them for pesach, so put them away. And dishwashers, best left alone for Pesach. You know, if they're actually, if they're stainless and you have separate racks, and what, there's, it's conceivable to kosher them. But as I say, I discourage it. If someone would ever figure out a heter to use them on the, after the storm, then I'd be all, you know, all for it, you know. Figure out how to, you know, a heter for the dishwashers. But since we don't have a heter to use them, so you take this year, we have 8 days of Yontif, four of them are Yontif, one of Shabbos, so what's left? On Friday, we don't have too many dishes as it is. And Sundays are of Yontif, also not going to be too many dishes. So, what are we going to use it for? In the world of products, there are really not too many new ideas. They didn't really not new things this year. I mean, what are they telling me? They have, you know, spiralized vegetables, you know, which are not, they do not normally present the chametz problem the way they're produced, you know. And other than that, there's really not much new in the world of kashrus this year. That doesn't mean there won't be. We never know about what last-minute surprises we're going to discover. If you add all things with commercially cut fruit, you're better off if you can have a hashgacha for it for Pesach. I'm not telling you it's mandatory, but you're far better off if you can, because in a lot of the fruits and pears and some other things, besides in potatoes, peeled potatoes, the wash that they use could contain kidneys in it. Bottom line, it's probably not a problem anyhow, because really, typically, it's washed off before it's used. There's really not much of an issue with it. But you're better off if you can find something with a Pesach Hechsher rather than one that's commercially produced without it. That's the basics. You know, mixers should not be kosherized for Pesach, period. The reason is very simple. The centrifugal force that's involved when they work sucks flour up into the motor housing. And if you open them up, you will invariably find flour inside. And flour is a very, very serious issue of chametz for Pesach. The flour is wet milled, which means it's soaked for a few hours before they actually mill it. That's for non-Passover use. And consequently, it may or may not be chametz. That's questionable. But the Gemara tells us there are ways to do it that are not chametz. But 1,000 years ago, we stopped doing it because we decided we're not expert enough to control it appropriately. And that's why all the flour that we use for Pesach for matzahs is in fact dry milled. The grain is not made wet. It's a much more difficult process than a wet milled flour. Drugs, listen, pills are not much of a problem, that's the truth, in the first place. And if you need to take liquids, so that you should make inquiry, and you're with your pharmacist, they usually have pretty good lists. But make inquiry early, because if they don't know, probably the best ones that have the information is the Starkey tends to be, on top of the medicines, more easier than anyone else that I found to deal with. You know, that's just, they happen to be on top of it. So consequently, if your medicine that you need for Pesach, and you're not sure if it's kosher or Pesach, so that's really, you know, a good address to go to. But by and large, most of the common medicines are included in the well-published list from my best from Los Angeles, I think makes the best list of all in terms of which medicines are kosher, which may have chametz in them. That's the best list that I found. It's from Rabbi Bess in the Kodol of Los Angeles. Rabbi Gershon Bess, B-E-S-S.
What about if someone is lactose intolerant and they need rice milk or soy milk?
The problem is something else. The problem is to find one which you know is going to be kosher to Pesach. That's not so simple. We could assume that there's not chametz directly in it. Is the chametz that got mixed into it in the process? So this we really, you know, and if someone really has such an issue and they can't not have milk for 8 days, then they should come ask a shayla. I put the OU up to this about 10 years or 12 years back to research all the supplements that they give to elderly people that are not well in nursing homes. And they spent the whole winter on it, and the information, they could not fully pin down all the information that they wanted. But they brought all the information that they had to Rabelsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and Rabelsky at that time wrote a tshuva that these supplements were permissible for people in ill health. There were enough questions, if there was any real issue to them, that for a person that was ill, he felt there should be mutter on yantav. So there is a basis, and you have to realize, if they're intended for people that have to be gluten-free, then they have to be very, very careful about how they produce it, that it's not really exposed to anything which has gluten in it. So there is basis to find the heter, but people should ask an individual shiloh about it.
What about for children, for babies?
Generally speaking, for babies, they used the soy formulas for them.
Yeah.
You know, but not in the kitchen. We don't wash them in the kitchen. They should have new bottles for Pesach. Okay. Yes?
Napkins, paper towels, paper plates?
There's little to the shyness that have anything to do with these things. And yeah, if you want to be on the machmer side, which I don't, as I said, Pesach, we have all types of chumras, is don't use the plain paper plates, especially not for hot. You know, the plain, the cheapest ones, use either the styrofoam or plastic. The napkins, I don't see any issue with altogether. And the paper towels, you throw away the sheets in the beginning and end up have the glue on them. There is, by the way, I don't know how long this is in the market. I became aware of it now. I never focused upon it before. It was very, very difficult to get in the retail markets decaffeinated coffee for Pesach. It has existed in the wholesale market, you know, for institutional use for many years already. But in the reason is the decaffeination process usually involves an alcohol extraction process by which they extract the caffeine by exposing it to alcohol. And the question is, at the end of the day, is there any of that alcohol left? Chemically, they don't think so. If halachically it becomes mutter again, is an open question. So none of the agencies was certifying it. But I became aware this year, and as I said, it may have existed before, but I just became aware of it, that you have Taster's Choice coffee that comes from Israel with the Hechsher Chuk Sam Sofer, which is kosher LePesach. As I say, it's not been particularly relevant to me. I just happened to be, I bumped into it this year. Yeah.
What nuts from Costco that are already cut in half?
Nuts that are already cut in half. They're not the greatest thing to use. And especially most of them have some additives to them for preservatives and other things. If they were basically pretty much whole and they did not have additives in them, then there's basis to allow them for Pesach. But again, that you should really check on a case-by-case basis. I don't want to give an absolute.
I just want to say, last year I called Costco. The only thing that was okay to use was the almonds, raw almonds. Everything else, the lady was extremely cooperative and made research with each plant. I thought the walnuts might have been good, or the pecans. That was good to use.
They have additives to them, most of them. That is the problem, yeah.
Trader Joe's. Last year, at least, they had a lot of the Trader Joe's you could use on Pesach.
Yeah.
What says OUT?
The nuts. OU book has a list of the nuts that don't need kosher Pesach certification, and Trader Joe's had a lot of them on.
Yeah.
The spritzer by the sink. Can you replace the handle?
You can replace the handle if it's plastic, but if the tube itself is plastic, then it's not a good deal for Pesach. Yeah.
My friend said she had it's her whole thing is it's just a spritzer, if that's how it is.
If that's all you have, then kosherize it for Passover. Yes. Yeah.
Is there anything to, like, Wasserman themselves, those faucet covers that look kind of like nylons or something to cover it?
Listen, as I say, how careful and meticulous a person wants to be, is for them to choose. You know, there is a basis for it because chametz does spill in those places. So good, as I advise people on the spout to dump hot water on it. One's less likely, if you have faucets behind the sink, to actually have food come directly in contact. But some may want to be particular about it, and I respect it.
What about, like, speaking of which, not the faucet, but with the hands to turn the water on and off?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Normally, wash them well. Now, the handles of the range top and the stove, you should also, they usually tend to come off. If they come off, take them off. Soak them in something like ammonia and water to be sure that they're absolutely clean. If you can, dump hot water on them also, and then put them back on. Yeah.
So Costco is selling cakes from Century Bakery with an okay.
Yeah.
What I noticed about them is like it's not sealed in such a way that like the label is taped on. It's a cardboard thing that wraps around. It's easy to slide off and on. So, I mean, is that a problem?
As I say, is it mutter mitzaradin? Yes. Do you want to use it? That's a question how careful you want to be. Are you concerned that somebody opened it up and closed it again? Mitzaradin, listen, I don't think anyone could substitute. Their cakes are quite, you know, unique. You can't substitute them. But as I say, in general, this is a problem that I have with kashrus throughout the year. I'm often called as the chairman of the Vada Kashrus of Queens, that somebody called and they got a food delivery and it wasn't taped closed. So I tend to tell them, usually send it back and tell them you don't want it because it wasn't closed. Is it mutter mitzaradin? Yes. Most of the time, almost all the time, not all the time, but almost all the time, mitzaradin, it's mutter. But the problem is the storekeepers are not supposed to be sending it out that way. But this is a universal problem throughout the world. So, yeah.
Do the knobs have to be covered or once you pour each
other? The knobs of what?
They
don't have to be covered. Once you've soaked them and you pour hot water on them, I would not worry to cover them. Yeah.
The non-self-clean oven, when you're covering the room, you can leave the opening for the heat to come up. Do you put openings in the oven for the heat to come up?
And where?
The non-self-clean out bottom.
Wherever, you make sure that you don't cover up the vents, yeah. Okay. That you have to do. Did both? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You said we don't have to cover the shelves in the refrigerator. That goes for the freezer too, I assume.
Yes, yes.
You said plates, but you know, like Dixie has a paper with the coat, like the heavier plastic, the heavier paper. Can we use those?
And Dixie, they're usually those are the ones that have like wax on them. You should not be using them Pesach.
Or any like amazing savings that they have those picture plates, you can't use those?
I don't know what they are exactly. If they're the simple paper plates, either styrofoam or plastic you should use for Pesach. That's what you should use. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned the knobs with the hot water. Are we supposed to kosher the sink first and then put the non-kosher knobs in and pour it? Or
doesn't make a difference, because remember, anything you're kashering you didn't use for the last 24 hours before you kasher it. Before Pesach, it's of no consequence. Yeah. So it's fine. I would kasher the sink first and then dump it. But either way, it doesn't make a difference. It's fine. Yeah. Yeah, it's a cardboard type of plastic. Yeah, they sell it in all the hardware stores and all over the place.
And the dining room table also?
That's what I put in the dining room table, yes. Kitchen, also. Kitchen and dining room, yeah. Okay, anything else?
How about
those foam bags? Listen, I'm not so keen on it because they could very easily get a hole in them. You know, I'd like to say that's why it's worth.
A table pad you told me to buy last year.
Well, good. That's something else. That's thick. Yeah. That's fine. You know, that's just a tablecloth with a little flannel backing. There's not, you know.
Oh,
if it's like a table pad, yeah, I have no problem. That's fine. Yeah.
Leather
would be fine.
By itself?
What?
By itself, recently put the.
If it's thick leather, I don't think you need to put anything else onto it. That's what I think.
Can you clean
all
of it?
No. I do try to clean it. Go ahead.
You mentioned the cover on the sink spout. I don't want to be spouses like this.
I didn't say you have to. I just said if you want to.
Would it save me the trouble of having to splash?
No, it wouldn't save you the trouble, no. you're drawing water out of it, hot water out of it, so you have to be sure that it's kosher for Pesach. Yeah.
I'll mention that 24 hours younger if the sink should not be used
These things that come to the Shabbos right before, it's a little tricky because...
So it's okay. To the contrary, it's much better. If you're not going to use it for more than 24 hours over Shabbos with hot water. So that's all. Just make sure you don't pour soup or whatever, chulim.
Hot,
cold is not a problem, yeah. So Shabbos makes it easier because you're guaranteed no one's putting on the hot water.
Is the thick aluminum foil sufficient that thick for the countertop, or should you use the head laminates?
That's enough for the countertop. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
The stove tops, some of those knobs are plastic. You have to capture them and just put it on the
bottom. Yeah, you should dump hot water on them too.
Dump hot water on
yes,
them?
Yes, yes, yes.
Soak them in a bowl of hot water?
Yeah, no, one that soaked them, yeah, but you should dump hot water on them, yeah. In case something spilled on them. Oh. Now, in general, you know that I have a strong antipathy to kashering things for Pesach. You know, other than the basic equipment of the house, dishes, pots, pans, whatever. The domestic pots and pans, the way they're made, is not designed to kasher them for Pesach. They're very nice and cutesy, you know, with the curled ends on the top, but they also, the curled ends, have all types of dirt that gets into them that you can't really get out. You know, but just about the only thing I like to kasher for Pesach in today's world is, you know, if you have your becher, if you don't have one for Pesach, kasher it. That's, you know, that's almost to the extent that you don't even need to kasher it. We kasher it because maybe it got washed with the chametz sometime during the year, which is a good chance, so we kasher it. But those are not the thing. Other than that, I shy away from kasher to the greatest extent. Yeah.
Do you have like a boiler drawer underneath the oven? What do you do with that?
Clean it out, and that's all, and don't use it for Pesach.
Just like turn on anything or no?
Yeah, if you put it on, it's fine. Whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
The refrigerator, if someone has like an ice maker or water maker, do you have to do anything?
Just
to
wash it out. That's all. You just wash it, empty it, and wash it. That's all. It's nice to have long candles for the Seder. You know, the candles are supposed to be a part of Sudas Shabbos and Sudas Yontif. And on Pesach, we tend to eat later than we do during the year. So it's nice if we have longer candles that'll last throughout. Don't make them that long that they'll be still burning when you go to sleep, that you don't want, you know. Yes, yatzel ledes pohat. You know, most times people don't put them on counters because they're afraid of splitting the counters. If you put something on a stone counter that's too hot, you could crack it. So most people, for that reason, just don't do such things. And I was standing in the yeshiva kitchen once at a shiloh, and a worker came through. He was working. So he started, he said, I had a guy in my house who stood on the granite counter, whatever device. I wanted to break his head for him. I spent thousands of dollars on it. I don't need him climbing on it to crack it for me, you know. Yeah. Under the stove and under the fridges. Okay. That's my favorite question. The Gemara says in Pesachim that if there's a mapolis, if you had a cave-in, and this, even if there's chametz under it, you don't have to clean it out. You don't have to dig it up. The place where Moshe Zatzal included said that any place that a person does not normally go to during the year, you have no obligation to clean out for Pesach. So you don't have to pull out your fridge. You don't have to pull out your stove. And I'm still looking for a few volunteers. You know that I want to make a new Jewish day. On May 15th, National Jewish Spring Cleaning Day, you know? But safely after Pesach. We're not here to do spring cleaning. It's hard enough to make Yontif without the additional burden of spring cleaning. Bedikas Chometz, Rav Moshe Zatzal said, only applies to a piece which is large enough that it doesn't have to be a kazayas, but a piece that you might pick up to eat. If it's smaller than that, all the kalim that you put away and sell to the guy, you can leave whatever you want in them. You don't have to clean them out. I don't care how much chametz is in them. Just put them away, lock them up, and goodbye. Don't bother to clean them. Now, I'll tell you also something which is very, very important. It'll make life a lot easier. Rav Yoshev, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, is a Haggadah that he put out of his, and at the beginning he has a great deal of his psukim, his Piskei Halacha. And he wrote the following, that if when your house is cleaned, either it's cleaned by a frum woman, or it's cleaned by a non-frum woman, or a non-Jewish woman, and the balabusta goes and checks what she does when she's finished, before she puts the room back together and sees that it's clean, that there's no obligation to do bedikas chametz in such a place. So this is a very, very important thing. We have big houses and a lot of possessions, and it's just hard to get around all of them to do bedikas chametz, to actually look in every single place. So this is a way to resolve that issue. And obviously, by and large, most of the bedikas chametz you do either with a flashlight or the room lights. For tradition's sake, you may want to start with a candle, but a candle is not very effective for two reasons. Number one, it has a very minimal amount of light. Number two, the Gemara says in Psochem that one should not use a torch to do bedikas chametz because he won't go into small places because he's afraid he's going to burn the place down. Our homes are set up as such that candles are not good to be in most of the places, not near the bedding, and not near the linen, and not near the draperies. There's too much damage that they can do. So you use them a little bit for tradition and then blow them out and go about the rest of the bedikas chametz with a flashlight or put on the room lights. Yeah?
Chametz gomor, what does, like, I just heard that barley is not.
Barley is apparently not chametz gomor because it's not, the pearled barley is not their whole grains. Nothing has happened to cause them to become chametz. Generally speaking, chametz gomer is either pasta or bread, cookies. And anything with a mixture of chametz has to be at least 1/8 chametz to be considered chametz gomer. If it's not, if it's less than that, it's considered teruvus chametz.
Unopened things of flour,
I tend to be maker of. Heinemann is maker about it. And a lot of the research in this country indicates, in fact, I just was speaking to someone that has a lot of expertise in kashrus today. He works for one of the national agencies. And I said he's examined grain 3 hours after it's been soaked in water, which they do for to prepare it for to make it into flour, to mill it, and it still was not chometznik. So the greatest likelihood is that it's certainly not more than a suffix if it's chometz. Toys are very simple. Most of the toys today are made of plastic. Take all the toys, throw them in the bathtub, fill it up with water, put ammonia in and let it soak overnight, rinse them off tomorrow, and they'll all be kosher to Pesach. Now, if you have little kids, from this point on, after Rosh Chodesh Nisan, don't give them chametz snacks. Just give them everything, give them to run around the house with cookies, whatever, should be kosher to Pesach, and therefore once you clean, it'll stay clean. Otherwise, you're going to be cleaning your house forever. Yeah.
Braces and a permanent retainer?
Braces and a permanent retainer. My basic feeling is, if you have braces or a permanent retainer, you should not be eating chametz for 24 hours before the Zman Isser. So the Zman Isser is about 10:22. On Monday morning from 10:22, Sunday morning, you should not be eating chametz, neither hot nor cold. When I came to this conclusion, so some people came to tell me that, Rabbi, you're so machmer. What do you have to be so machmer for? I spoke to an orthodontist. He said, Rabbi, why are you so makel? You know, when I. So I'll leave it at this point. I think that halachically I'm on sound basis. Yeah.
If let's say two people sell chametz gomor, but they don't have room in their house, could they, if they sell it by the same person, give to their friend to hold
chametz
for them for
them
to
be sold
or not?
Yes, they can give it to their friend to hold
chametz. But they don't have to give them any money or something?
No, they don't have to give it to them. If you're putting it in someone else's house, it's preferable to write that address in the Shtar Mechiras chametz too. Yeah.
What if you have meat in your freezer and it's not Pesach? There's nowhere else to put it.
So just put it in one area and cover over that area is enough.
And sell that?
Yes. You don't need to sell it. I don't need to sell it, but you just cover over that area so you won't use it Pesach.
Why is meat not Pesach?
Why? Because it may have been produced. You know, I had a friend in the meat business many years ago. So the basic problem is, did they eat lunch in the back when they were preparing, cutting up the meat or not? So good. If you want, you know, you can let it defrost. And once it's soft, then you could rinse it off well and you could actually use it, except chopped. Anything chopped, you cannot. So, but most people don't want to just bother with it to let it defrost to get soft and then rinse it off and then first start to cook it. So they put it away.
Okay, I think you mentioned this, but
if you have a room where you put things that you don't want to deal with, you know, common things, do you have to clean them, and how will you have to
clean them? You don't have to clean them at all. You can leave bread in them. Okay? Yes. Okay? If you were a machmer, not the so chametz gomer, so take any, if you have a slice of bread in there, take it out. That's all. Yeah, yeah. Wherever you put the chametz should be sealed in a way that no one's going to go in without realizing they don't belong there on Pesach. Now, you should put all your non-Pesach kelim away well. Don't leave them lying around, because you may find if you leave them around that somebody took them by mistake. Put them in an area separate, clearly away, covered, marked, that no one takes them out. You know, you have whatever. If you have a liquor cabinet, so go put all your chumba stick of liquor on one shelf and close it up. Yeah.
Can you please make clear, just for me, what do I have to throw out and what can I put away?
That depends on your minhag. I cannot tell you. This, I'll be strict halacha. You can save anything that you want. Open, closed, bread, pasta, you can sell it all. There are many that follow the practice of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was not a fan of our Mechiras Chometz, and he did not sell Chometz, full-fledged Chometz for Pesach. And many follow that view, but that depends what your minhag is. You know, Taruvas Chometz you can sell. Whatever Taruvas means is less than 1/8 Chometz in the mixture. And as long as it keeps you out of there, that's fine.
On the stovetop, there's this like round, like ceramic or something that goes on top of the jets.
That's nothing, and the pots never touch it. Just wash them clean, and that's all.
You have to use hot water? No.
Avi.
Back to the stovetop. I don't like the stovetop. The handles that come off a lot of times is a collection of there. Of chametz. So is it good enough if I just cover that chametz with a big pen?
You have to take the handles off and clean under them, if you can.
But if you put too much water sometimes...
No, you don't need water. Just take something barely damp, like a piece of stainless, and just barely damp. You're right. You can really light the guy to repair stovetops. So if you have an electric one, use water on its top, but I guarantee you'll have them there for Yontif, you know?
Another thing is the tablecloth. We should have new tablecloths?
Best to have new ones, yes.
Don't wash that stuff.
If they're washed and they're 100% clean without stains, you could use them for Pesach. Yeah.
If I have a coffee table that I put food on during the year, should I cover that?
Yes. If it's a place that you typically put food, you should cover it for Pesach.
We have less stovetop. We didn't buy a game of the house.
We'll talk privately about it.
So the first year we covered it, the Rav said, with great trepidation, Baruch Hashem so far hasn't cracked. The stovetop is next to the counters, two counters on each side. And what I do is I cover it all up with foil and I put down the, cover it on the counter, but I cut slits along the side so the heat can vent out. Is that a problem?
No, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. Yeah.
What are countertops? Quartzite. It's supposed to be a natural stone, but it's metamorphic as opposed to granite, which is igneous stone. Should that be okay?
I don't know exactly what it is. Is it because
it's not quartz. Quartz is a mixture of something, stone and plastic. Quartzite is sandstone that has been somehow compressed in metamorphic rock.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with it. I'm not going to answer.
Between the OU and the
Blumenkrantz
about the shampoos and
what
each part of it all.
Listen, the OU was right, and that's all. Listen, it's very simple. The OU was right. I've personally held that way always. The CRC's Besdin, and including Rav Shmuel First, who's one of the choshes to Rabbanim in Chicago, put out a letter on this a number of years ago. As I said, Amachmer Yachmer La'atzmo. But you cannot impose this as a chumrah on the rav. Absolutely not. Liquid what?
Any kind of cosmetic.
No. Some, it's preferable not to use the ones that actually have real chumetz gomer in them, which are a very small number. Usually you'll find out if it has grain alcohol in it, which is very, very little. Usually you can find out which ones have it. You know, most of the alcohol is synthetic. It's not grain. Yeah.
Wine for the Seder night. Can you just tell us the percentage?
Wine for the Seder night. The Gemara says the following in Arim Sochem, that there are two aspects to drinking wine at the Seder. One is to drink wine, and that the Gemara refers to, and the Gemara refers to something as Cheirus, a celebration of freedom. Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal was a real person. Rav Moshe knew that when you make a L'chaim, you don't make a L'chaim on grape juice. It doesn't cut it. You know, you take out a bottle of whiskey if you want to celebrate something, and you pour a L'chaim. I came once... I came once to the founding of a tzedakah I guess the rabbinical person, and there were two very wealthy gentlemen that were involved. And this took place in a house in Forest Hills for a family, whatever, of Yisaimim. And the first thing, we sat down around a little table. And the Balabayas was a European gentleman, Oliver Shalom, a very noble man. He took out three glasses, he put them on the table, he poured three l'chaims, he made a l'chaim, and then we got to work. And I tell you, his bracha of l'chaim was phenomenal, because this stocker was just unbelievably successful. So the Gemara says, an Indian of Cheirus. Ramosha says, Cheirus does not mean to drink grape juice. Cheirus implies that there's an alcoholic beverage that's involved. Not everyone agrees with him, but the Seichel would seem to dictate that he's right. So the question is, my personal feeling, it should be as close to 6% as you can get. Sometimes it might be 5.5%, because up to 6% is sold in New York as a wine drink. It's not sold as wine. So even if you don't have a liquor license, you can sell things. So it should be as close to 6% as you get if you're able to deal with that. You know, if you can't deal with it, then you can use grape juice throughout the whole thing, if that doesn't work. Or a mix, if that works. Now, I do want to point out the following. That, as I said, we try to do everything at the highest standard, but we do have to know what the bottom line is. Because if I'm not at the position, for whatever reason, to do things at the highest standard, at least I should know what's the minimum requirement to fulfill the din. Now, I'm asked so many times, people, I have trouble with wine, I have trouble with grape juice. So then I ask everyone, listen, let me tell you. What you're obligated to do, a revius of wine, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, a revius is 3 ounces. You're obligated to drink a majority of 3 ounces, which means 1.51 ounces. And you have to do that 4 times. I said, there are very, very few people that I meet up with that are going to tell me that they're going to have problems if they drink 6 ounces of grape juice throughout the course of a night, unless they're a very, very severe diabetic. So that's all one has to drink to fulfill the din. Everything else, have a larger case and a larger share and drink over the coast and the whole coast. They're all nice things, but they're not obligatory. And the same thing comes for matzah. You know, there's all different types of shiurim for matzah. If a person has trouble for whatever reason, whether they have a celiac problem or other issues, they should come and ask a rav, and the shiurim, which are much smaller than the classical ones that the community uses today, which... signed off on by Gdei Le'olim, by a great Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva, signed off on them. Yeah.
For the Rosh Matzahs, let's say, what's the recommended shear?
The recommended shear, it's a little bit more than half. My matzahs are approximately 75 square inches. Ramosha's shear is about 42 square inches. It's a little bit more than half, if you followed Ramosha's shear. Yeah.
Shabbos is good. What do we do for
challah?
Can we use egg matzah?
You can use egg matzah, yes.
Is egg matzah chametz, or it's not?
It's not chametz, no. It's not chametz. You can put it on the table, yes, with
we
Pesach.
Put it with Pesach.
Yes, yes. We just don't eat it on Pesach, that's all. Yeah.
We're also at 6%. That means at least, or
we... Yeah, well, we can go up as much as you can handle, you know. But, you know, the problem is that you have to realize with all the matzah and the morah and everything else, it makes it a little bit harder to handle. You know, we have a preference for red wine on Pesach. Now, red wine, this is important. Red wine does not mean a white wine that you pour a little bit of red into. Red is not a color issue. Red wine and white wine, as is well known in the world of health, are two different types of things. All the health advantages have to do with red wine and not white wine. And the reason is because the skins in them have certain chemicals which don't wind, they'll get into the white wine. Juice, basically, if you squeeze out a grape, no matter what the grape, is basically white. It's the skins that are in there that ferment together with the wine that give it the coloring. And so red wine is not a color. Red wine is a certain chemical composition. So to put, you know, pour a drop of red wine into white wine, that's, you know, it's nice for a plate, but it doesn't make it, you know, for Pesach.
Is this going to be non-revushal?
What?
Non-revushal?
The wine should be non-revushal, but that's making the following assumption, that you don't have any non-frum guests coming to your Seder, and you don't have non-frum help that's going to be ubiquitous. You know, I was at a Seder many, many years ago. The year was Tovshin Lamed Gimel. And I was in Eretz Yisrael that year. And I was the guest of Rav Kanarek, Shlita Rav Shiva in Eretz Yisrael of the yeshiva. I was his guest for Pesach. But I had a problem for the second day and the eighth day because he was permanently in Eretz Yisrael, so he didn't keep those 2 days. So the Rav Shiva Zatzal and the Rebbetzin and all the Asholem invited me to be their guest. So I spent the second Seder, the second day Yontif with them, and I think the last day Yontif as well. So anyhow, after the first night of Yom Tov is always an interesting night, and there's people at all types of storm floating around. Anyhow, there's some guy that fell into the yeshiva to sleep the first night of Yom Tov, comes downstairs the first night of Yom Tov, and he meets the Rebbetzin Halei HaShalom in the hall. Now, what can I tell you? The Rebbetzin was a fireball. She knew how to be very nice to people, but she was a fireball. So this guy meets her in the hall the first day of Yom Tov, and what's on his mind? He wants to get to Tel Aviv because he's supposed to be at the second Seder in Tel Aviv. So he doesn't know how to get to, where's he going to find a taxi to get, or a bus, you know, a taxi to get him to Tel Aviv on the first day of Yom Tov. Anyhow, the Rebbetzin got on his case in a nice way and convinced him that he should stay in Yerushalayim and that he should be the guest of the Rosh Hashanah and the Rebbetzin for the second day of Yom Tov. So we actually sat across from me at the Seder. Now, they were not planning to have any non-frum guests at the Seder, and therefore the wine was not mevushel. Well, sure enough, the guy happened to pick up the wine and pour himself some. And the Rebbetzin very unobtrusively, a couple of few minutes later, came and just took the bottle of wine and disappeared into the kitchen, never to be seen again. So you do have to know who you're going to have at the Seder. If you're going to have people at the Seder that are not frum or non-Jews that are going to come to clean, then you probably don't want to have one that's not mevushel. Yeah.
Somebody asked me, they wanted to know, what is exactly not from, is that they don't keep shop?
That's, I'm not going to, that's not a shayla to ask, that's an individual shayla that I will answer privately, not in public. Okay. So, may the Rabbanu Shalom give us all the wisdom to prepare for Yom Tov well, do what we have to, and remember that at the end of the day, that Simchas Chachag, B'Samachnu, is a mitzvah deraisa. And we have to arrive B'Simcha at the Yom Tov.